Rumpole and the Old Familiar Faces by John Mortimer, with Desmond Barrett as Horace Rumpole.
I, Horace Rumpole, barrister at law, criminal defender. Well, that is to say, I'm not, of course, myself a criminal. Not at all. I defend people about whom it's suggested they might have committed crimes. I, a Rumpole of the Bailey, an Old Bailey hack, tormentor of judges, thorn in the flesh of prosecutors, attorney general to the Timpson family, who live, on the whole, respectably, on the windy side of the law. I am here to announce quite honestly that I have no rooted objection to Christmas. It is, however, a period when time hangs heavy on the hands. The Old Bailey's closed for the holidays. The better class of villain is taking a winter break on the Costa del Crime. I think my real objection to Christmas is that no one is being tried for anything. There was one Christmas, however, when the unexpected appearance over the festive season of some old familiar faces led to unexpected results and to my triumph in two widely different cases. It began when I happened to mention the one Christmas institution that lit up my childhood and
no
early...
No question, the Great British Pantomime. There's nothing to beat it.
We were being entertained by the Erskine Browns in the open-plan kitchen with dining area of their up-to-the-minute Islington home.
You go to the pantomime much, Rumpole?
Ah, Claude, not since childhood.
Claude Erskine Brown, QC. I always think those letters stand for queer customer. Claude is a fearless opera-goer and nervous advocate.
When I was a boy, it was my annual treat. It made a profound impression on me.
When you were a boy, the truth of the matter is that Rumpole's never quite grown up, and it's not only the pantomime.
Pantomime? Is that a kind of mime show? Guys dressed as clowns, feeling imaginary walls, no one saying anything.
No, funnier than that. Robin Hood's mother was played by a red-nosed clown.
A female comic?
No, a male one.
I don't know what sort of an idea of England you're giving the judge, Rumpole.
We have clubs for that sort of thing in Pittsburgh, and a website, transvestites.com.
There's nothing sexual about it. The dame's a character who gets the audience singing.
Singing?
Yes, the words of the song come down on a sort of giant sheet, and she, who was really a he, gets the audience to sing along.
And it's intensely embarrassing.
Keep your salmon and lobster too. Feed your mackerel to seals at the zoo. For breakfast and dinner, I've only one wish. The glorious sight of my favourite dish. All together, come on!
Emboldened by the Erskine Brown's claret, smoother on the tongue and with more of a kick than my usual Chateau Thames embankment, I broke into a stanza of the song I was introduced to in my youth by Robin Hood's masculine
yours for life.
That'll be quite enough. Every time we're asked out to dinner, I beg him not to sing.
Ah, golden memories. I'm afraid I got carried away.
You know, Mr. Rumpole, I think you were wrong. I do detect in that song you just sang some undercurrent of sexual innuendo.
I have to admit, it passed me by.
I see they're doing Aladdin at the Tufnell Park Empire. Do you think the twins might enjoy it, Rumpole?
Ah.
We took them to Bayreuth last year.
The speaker was Mrs. Justice Erskine Brown. Phyllida Trant, as she was in happier days, when I first called her the Portia of our chambers. She was still possessed of a beauty that would break the hearts of the toughest prosecutors and made old lags tremble with lust, even as she passed a stiff custodial sentence.
I think the twins would adore the pantomime.
The twins were Tristan and Isolde, so named by her opera-loving husband, Claude.
Just the thing to cure the Wagnerian death wish and bring them into a world of sanity.
Sanity? With old guys dressed up as mothers?
I promise you they'll love every minute of it. I know I would. And I'll tell you what, Philadelphia...
And then I made another promise that sounded rash, even as I spoke the words.
I'll take them myself.
Oh, thank you, Rumpo.
No, it'll have to be after Christmas.
My wife Hilda, known to me only as she who must be obeyed, briskly postponed the promise of Aladdin and his wonderful lamp.
We're invited up to Norfolk for the holiday.
Norfolk? Oh, God.
As she said the word Norfolk, a cold, sneeping wind seemed to cut through the central heating of the Erskine Browns' Islington dining room, and I felt a warning shiver.
Oh, good God.
The ritual of Christmas at home in Froxbury Mansions was to be rudely interrupted. The exchange of presents, the tie which I would seldom wear, the annual bottle of lavender water, which Hilda lays down rather than puts to immediate use, would have to take place in the stranger's house. I had grown used to the Queen's speech at home, when I lay bets with myself as to whether Hilda will stand yet again to attention when the telly plays the national anthem. The thawed-out bird from Safeways, followed by port, an annual gift from my faithful solicitor, Bonnie Bernard. And then pudding was to be abandoned for an unpredictable meal with people I'd never met. We sat in a sullen train which dawdled northwards.
Why are we going to Norfolk exactly?
I was at school with Poppy Longstaff.
What's that got to do with it?
How many times have I got to tell you, Rumpo? How many times?
I knew the answer to this question, of course. Hilda's old school has this in common with polar expeditions, natural disasters, and World War II. Those who have lived through it are bound together for life and can always call on each other for mutual assistance.
Poppy's Eric is rector of Cold Sands. And for some reason or other, he seems to want to meet you, Rumpo.
Meet me?
That's what she said.
So does this mean I have to spend Christmas in the Arctic Circle and miss our festivities?
It's not the Arctic Circle. It's Norfolk, Rumpo.
Yes.
And our festivities aren't all that festive. So try and be grateful to Poppy and her husband. And don't spend the whole of Christmas talking about old murders. Some people don't like that.
Oh, God. My first impression of Cold Sands was of a gaunt church with a spire, presumably of great age, pointing an accusing finger to heaven from a cluster of houses on the edge of a sullen gunmetal sea. My second was one of intense cold. Soon as we got out of the taxi, we were slapped around the face by a wind which must have started in freezing Siberia and gained nothing in the way of warmth on its journey across the plains of Europe. At the rectory, we were greeted cheerfully by Poppy Longstaff.
At last, Horace. Hilda's told me so much about you. And Eric's so looking forward to meeting you. Can I take your overcoat?
I thought I might keep it on, just for the moment.
Oh, don't be ridiculous, Rumpo. Let Poppy hang it up for you.
Yes.
And the muffler?
Hilda's friend had one of those round, childishly pretty faces often seen on seriously large women. And she seemed to keep going on incessant cups of hot, sweet tea.
Eric?
And a number of cards.
He's in his study, just putting the last-minute touches to his sermon. Can I offer you a cup of tea?
She moved like an enormous tent into the house, and we followed her.
Eric is having terrible trouble with the church spire.
I was thinking longingly of my overcoat. Frosty winds made considerable moan round the rectory, owing to the doors that stopped about an inch short of the stone floors, and the windows which never shut properly, causing the curtains to billow like the sails of a ship at sea.
We are an ancient foundation granted by William Rufus to the monks of Coldsands.
The rector was a slender, wraith of a man, with a high, aquiline nose, two flapping wings of grey hair on each side of his face, and a vague air of perpetual anxiety, broken now and then by high and unexpected laughter. He made cruciform gestures, as though remembering the rubric, spectacles, testicles, wallet, and watch, and forgetting where these important articles were kept.
The church of St. Barnabas was originally Norman, of course, and the Gothic spire didn't come till later.
Oh, such an historic little building. I'm afraid Rumpole isn't a great frequenter of churches.
No. It was from the top of our spire that watch was kept for the Armada, and sailors used it to steer by.
That's
in dense fog, they pointed their ships towards the sound of Cold Sands bells.
Oh. Yes.
And now our dear old spire is in urgent need of repair.
It happens to all of us, doesn't it, Rumpole?
Speak for yourself, was what I didn't say.
£100,000... £100,000. That's what we need.
And what have you got?
After the emergency jumble sale, £45. You can see we've got some way to go.
Yes, you have indeed.
A small sherry.
Ah,
lovely.
Yeah, rather lovely, yes.
You particularly wanted to see Rumpole this Christmas, Eric. Did you want his advice? On a legal matter?
Not really.
Just as well.
Yes, I can't remember why I wanted to see you this Christmas. I can't for the life of me remember. I mean, I don't believe you've got 100,000 smackers in your back pocket, have you, Rumpole?
Your lack of faith is entirely justified.
I wasn't exactly enjoying Cold Sands Rectory, and I was a little miffed that the Reverend couldn't remember why he'd asked me there in the first place.
We had hoped that Donald Compson would help us out. I mean, he wouldn't notice 100,000.
Oh, yes, we had high hopes of Mr. Compton.
Really?
Is this Compton some sort of spire lover, then?
He's got wonderful taste. He bought the old manor house, and he's done it up beautifully. And I have to tell you, Hilda, of course, he's not a young man anymore, but he is what we used to call at school a dish to dream of.
As dishy as Mr. Flanner, who took us for extra art.
Far dishier than Mr. Flanner.
I looked at she who must be obeyed and wondered if she'd ever call me a dish to dream of. I thought, on the whole, probably not.
Donald Compton is, you might say, the perfect English gentleman.
And they don't come more perfect than that.
English, with some slight but extremely attractive accent.
He spent some years in Canada, making his millions.
And, of course, he's been very generous.
He gave us the cricket pavilion and a tennis court for the school.
Oh, mad about sport, you see, Hilda. And he looks enormously fit.
Really? Rumpole takes absolutely no exercise. I've offered to buy him weights.
I take exercise. Drawing stiff corks out of bottles of Pomeroy's Plonk. Oh, by the way, Eric, the tide seems to have gone down in this glass of sherry.
Donald Compton's got a charming young wife who is not in the least standoffish.
Oh, neither is he. All that money and not a bit of side to him.
But he wouldn't chip in to save the spire.
He might have done, but you know Eric.
Not very well, yes.
He does rather tend to put his foot in it. The Remembrance Day service. We held it outside by the war memorial. Donald Compton was there, of course, looking very distinguished. Unfortunately, Eric asked us to pray for the enemy that fell in battle.
And their families.
And their families.
Well, it seemed to me only fair.
Oh, perhaps fair, darling, but hardly tactful.
Mr. Compton walked away from the service.
Still looking terrifically distinguished.
I've done hours of hard knee work, begging the Lord to soften Donald Compton's heart towards our spire. No results so far, I fear.
Oh.
Sorry to hear that.
He'll be in church on Christmas Day, Hilda, and you'll see what I mean by dishy.
I can't wait.
And we're all invited for drinks at the manor, so I haven't quite given up hope.
Oh. He asks everyone, you know. And, of course, it is an enormous privilege.
Poppy made it sound as though the Pope, the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop of Canterbury would be leading the carols and that we'd been invited to drop in for high tea at Windsor Castle. In church, I prayed for a yule log blazing at the manor so that I could, in the true spirit of Christmas, thaw out gradually. The church was beautiful, with a high timbered roof and walls of weathered stone, peppered with marble tributes to the dead inhabitants of the manor. It was decorated with holly and mistletoe, a tree glowed, and there were candles over a crib. High heaven rejects the law of nicely calculated less or more. So deemed the man who fashioned for the sense these lofty pillars, spread that branching roof, self-poised and scooped into 10,000 cells, where light and shade repose, where music dwells, lingering, and wandering on as loath to die. Like thoughts whose very sweetness yieldeth proof that they were born for immortality. Oh. So wrote Wordsworth, sublime poet and old sheep of the Lake District, who, although born without a single joke in him, oft comforts my solitary hours. He was describing quite another building, but his lines did rather well for Cold Sands Parish Church. I thought how many generations of Cold Sands inhabitants, their eyes bright and faces flushed with the wind, had belted out the hymns. I had found myself a place in church near to a huge, friendly, gently humming, occasionally belching radiator. And I was clinging to it and stroking it as though it were a new-found mistress. And not that I have much experience of new or even old-found mistresses. When the carol was over, a man left the row in front of me and stepped up to the lectern. A man of middle height with silvery hair, still handsome, and with a carefully preserved tan it must have been difficult to maintain under clouded Norfolk skies. He was dressed in a tweed suit, and as he unfolded a neat little pair of gold half-glasses and settled them on his nose, I was sure that he was Cold Sands' wealthiest citizen. The great Donald Compton would, of course, have been chosen to read the lesson.
The young man saith to him, all these things have I kept from my youth up. What lack I yet? And Jesus said unto him, if thou wilt be perfect, go and sell all thou hast, and give to the poor, and thou shalt have treasure in heaven.
I bet Donald Compton, millionaire lord of the manor, wished Jesus had never said any such thing.
Now, as a sign of Christmas fellowship, will you all stand and shake hands? hands, with those in front and behind you.
Eric, in full canonicals, standing on the steps of the altar, made the suggestion as though he'd just thought of the idea.
And wish each other a happy Christmas.
I smelled a discreet masculine aftershave, and the lord of the manor had turned to face me.
Happy Christmas.
Happy Christmas.
His soft brown eyes looked away from me almost at once. I felt a touch of his dry fingers, and then I was left, staring at his well-tailored back, after the most perfunctory of greetings.
Let us pray. Dearly beloved brethren, the scripture moveth us in sundry places to acknowledge and confess our manifold sins and wickedness, and that we should not dissemble or cloak them before the face of Almighty God, our Heavenly Father, but confess them with an humble...
I have to confess I wasn't listening to the prayers. I was otherwise engaged, wondering why it was that as the man in front of me touched my fingers and turned away, I felt that I had lived through that moment before, and many years ago. After the icy church, the manor house glowed with warmth and hospitality. There was, in fact, a huge log fire, crackling and throwing a dancing light on the marble floor of the circular entrance hall, with its great staircase leading up to private shadow. The cream of coal sands was being entertained to champagne and canapes by the new lord of the manor. The decibels rose as the champagne went down, and the little group began to sound like an army of tourists in the Sistine Chapel, noisy, excited, and wonderstruck.
But they must all be his ancestors.
She, who must be obeyed, was admiring the lines of portraits on the wall. Long-necked women gazing sadly over ruined temples, portly men decked with medals and sashes, with hungry-looking dogs licking their boots, old men in wigs looking cynical, as though they had seen it all and didn't believe a word of it. She had paused, an unaccustomed glass of champagne in her hand, before a scarlet-coated general on a prancing horse. Somewhere in the background, there was the smoke and carnage of a distant battlefield.
Donald Compton comes from a long line of military leaders. You can tell that from the way he stands.
My mouth was full of cream cheese enveloped in smoked salmon. I swallowed it to say,
they can't be his family portraits. After all, he only moved in here a couple of years ago.
Oh, but I expect he brought his family portraits here from somewhere else.
Oh, you mean he had them under the bed in the apartment in Calgary?
Try and be serious, Rumpole. You're not nearly as funny as you think you are. Just look at the family resemblance. I'm absolutely certain that all of these are old Comptons.
And it was when she said that that I remembered everything perfectly clearly. In the varied ups and downs, the thrills and spills in the life of an Old Bailey hack, one thing stands as stone. Your ex-customers will never want to see you again. Even if you've steered them through the rocks of the prosecution case and brought them out of the calm waters of a not guilty verdict, they won't plan further meetings, host reunion dinners, or even send you a card on your birthday. If they catch a glimpse of you on the underground or across a crowded wine bar, they will bury their faces in their newspapers or look studiously in the opposite direction. This is understandable. Days in court represent a period of time they'd rather forget. As a rule, I'm not especially keen to renew an old acquaintance when a face I once saw in the Old Bailey dock reappears at the Scales of Justice dinner. Reminiscences of the past are best avoided, and what is required is a quick look and a quiet turn away. But not, however, on this occasion. He was with his wife. She was wearing a black velvet dress and had long, fair hair that glittered in the firelight. They were talking to a bald, pink-faced man and his short and dumpy wife, and they were all laughing. Compton's laughter stopped as he saw me coming towards him.
Hello. Delightful party.
Yeah.
I don't think we've met.
Oh, yes, we have. We shook hands in the church this morning.
My name's Rumpole, and I'm staying with the Longstaffs. This is my wife, Lorelei.
Pleased to meet you.
And Colonel and Maudie Jacobs.
Lovely to meet you. Happy Christmas.
Yeah, what did you say your name was?
Rumpo. Horace Rumpo. Staying with the Longstaffs, you know.
Dear old Eric Longstaff. Saintly man, of course. Pity he blotted his copybook on Remembrance Day.
Praying for the enemy. Not the sort of thing you want to hear in church.
I do hope you're enjoying the Christmas holiday, Rumpole.
Well, it's not exactly a holiday. I'm here to do a job.
What sort of job, exactly?
Didn't Poppy tell us you're a lawyer?
Oh, you down here on a case.
What sort of case? And how exciting?
Well, not a case, exactly. I'm here to do a bit of fundraising.
Fundraising? Whatever for?
Well, as a matter of fact, for the spire of the church we were in today. We've met before, haven't we, Mr. Compton? Long ago.
Donald meets so many people.
You're a lawyer, Rumpole. I've got some books in the library, first-hand accounts of famous cases. Do you think that might interest you?
I think it might interest me very much.
Excuse us, darling, won't you?
Yes, of course. More champagne. Or maybe a little mulled wine.
Two words from Hilda had done it. Old and Compton. I knew then what I should have remembered when we touched hands in the pews, that Old Compton is a street in Soho. And that was perhaps why Ricardo, known as Dicko Peducci, had adopted the name. The Peducci territory had been in those days not rolling Norfolk acres, but a number of Soho strip clubs and clip joints.
Oi, care for a drink,
darling?
Come in for a drink and a chat, love.
Company, are you, my dear?
Girls would stand in front of these clubs and beckon to the lonely, the desperate and the unwary. Often they would escape with no more damage than £20 for a watery cocktail. Unlucky, affluent and important customers might even get invited to a cheaply scented love nest, well supplied with concealed microphones and hidden cameras, to produce material which was used for systematic and highly profitable blackmail. The victim in Dicko's trial was an obscure and not much loved circuit judge. Because of that, the case was regarded as particularly serious by the prosecuting authority.
Members of the jury, have you reached a verdict on which you're all agreed?
We have, my lord.
Do you find Ricardo Peducci guilty or not guilty of blackmail and keeping a bawdy house?
Guilty, my lord.
It was shortly before another long, distant Christmas that I rose to plead for a short sentence before His Honour Judge Bullingham, a task which would make turning base metal into gold look like a complete doddle.
Have you anything to say in mitigation of these horrible offences, Mr. Rumpole?
I certainly have.
I can't believe that even you
would ask for mercy. I certainly can, Milord. First of all, there's very little evidence of Peducci playing an active part in keeping this club.
This brothel, you mean?
He was hardly ever seen here. In fact, he rarely seems to have visited Soho. There's very little evidence that he knew exactly what was going on in the bar exotic.
He didn't go there because he was the big wheel, the boss man, the brains of the whole sordid organization. His non-appearance is a sign of guilt.
You mean you could go into a street and pick up a complete stranger and say he must be guilty because he never went there?
I didn't say that.
Then I misunderstood, Your Lordship.
Is that your best point, Mr. Rumpole?
No, my best point is that we're near Christmas.
What's Christmas got to do with it?
Christmas, my lord, has everything to do with it. It brings us the message that mercy will be shown even to the sinner, that our crimes and follies will be forgiven, that even the most misguided of us can hope for salvation. That, my lord, is the message of the story which began in a stable in Bethlehem.
And that story ends, to the best of my recollection, with a pretty sharp sentence on a couple of thieves. I can't pass a sentence of death in this disgusting case, Mr. Rumpole, which may be a matter of some regret. Is that all you have to say?
All, my lord. And at this time of Christmas, it should be enough.
Very well. Yes?
Will the defendant stand?
Riccardo Paducci, you have besmirched the fair name of old Compton Street, which used to be, if my memory serves me, a thoroughly respectable thoroughfare. You have also used the weaknesses of respectable citizens to extract money from them. You have even brought the law into disrepute. You and your like are the parasites that suck blood from the body politic. The least sentence I can, in all decency, pass upon you is one of 7 years' imprisonment. Take him down.
Look, I'm sorry. We were unlucky in our judge.
He didn't seem to like you much.
With what you can get off for good behavior, you could be out in no time.
Ah, forget it. Forget me. I know you will. I look after myself now. I might surprise them. I might surprise you.
Yes. Then I got the very same handshake, a slight touch, and a quick turn away that I had experienced in Coal Sands Church. Well, good luck, Dicko. Arrivederci.
I suppose it was going to happen sooner or later.
Not necessarily. We were standing in the library, drinking whiskey, in front of a comforting fire and among leather-bound books, which I strongly suspected had been bought by the Yard. The new, like the old Dicker, was soft-eyed, quietly spoken, almost unnaturally calm. The perfect man behind the scenes of a blackmailing operation or a country estate. You seem to have done pretty well for yourself. Solid citizens still misbehaving themselves round old Compton Street, are they?
I wouldn't know. I gave all that up and went into the property business.
Really? Where did you do that? Canada?
I never saw Canada. Garrick Prison. Up-and-coming area in the home counties. The screws there were ready and willing to do the deals on the outside. I paid them embarrassingly small commissions.
How long were you there?
4 years. By the time I came out, I'd got my first million.
Then I did you a good turn losing your case. A bit of luck, His Honour Judge Bullingham didn't believe in the remission of sins.
You think I got what I deserved?
Treat every man according to his deserts, I quoted Hamlet to him. And who shall escape whipping?
Then I can trust you, Rumpole. I've worked hard. I've earned the respect of the community here. The Lord Chancellor's going to put me on the bench.
The Lord Chancellor lives in a world of his own.
You don't think I'd do well as a magistrate?
Well, I suppose you'd speak from personal experience of law courts and have some respect for the quality of mercy.
I've got no time for that, Rumpole. I believe in cracking down hard on crime.
His voice became quieter but harder. The brown eyes lost their softness. That, I thought, was how he must have looked when one of his clip-joint girls was caught with the punter's cash stuffed in her tights.
Well, now, can I trust you not to go out there and spread the word about the last time we met?
That depends.
On what?
How well you understand the Christmas message.
Which is?
Perhaps, generosity?
Oh, I see. You want your bung.
Oh, not me, Dicko. I've been paid inadequately by legal aid. But there's an impoverished church spire in urgent need of resuscitation.
That Eric Longstaff. He's not a patriot.
And are you?
I do a good deal of work locally for the British Legion.
And I'm sure next Poppy Day they'll appreciate what you've done for the church spire.
He looked at me for a long minute in silence.
I thought that if this scene had been taking place in a back room in Soho, there might quite soon have been the flash of a knife. Instead, his hand went into an inside pocket and produced nothing more lethal than a checkbook.
While you're in a giving mood, the rectory is in desperate need of central heating.
Riccardo Paducci, now known as Donald Compton, looked at me, apparently deeply shocked.
This is bloody blackmail.
Very well, Dicko. You should know.
Christmas Day was over. The year turned, stirred itself, and opened its eyes onto a bleak January. Crimes were committed, arrests were made, and the courtrooms were filled once again with the sound of argument. I went down to the Old Bailey on a trifling matter of fixing the date of a trial before Mrs. Justice Erskine Brown. As I was leaving, the usher came and told me that the judge wanted to see me in her private room on a matter of urgency. Such summonses always fill me with apprehension and a vague feeling of guilt. What had I done? Got the date of a trial hopelessly muddled? Dressed the court with my trousers carelessly unzipped? I was relieved when the learned Phillida greeted me warmly.
My dear Rumpole, how lovely to see you. Sherry?
And even offered me a glass of sherry.
Thanks.
Poured from her own personal decanter.
It was so kind of you to offer, Rumpole.
Offer what?
Well, you told us how much you loved the traditional British pantomime.
Yes, so I did.
For a happy moment, I imagined her ladyship as principal boy, her shapely legs encased in black tights, her neat little wig slightly askew, slapping her thigh and calling out in bell-like tones, "Cheer up, Rumpole. Portia's not far away."
The twins are looking forward to it enormously.
looking forward to what?
Aladdin at the Tufnell Park Empire. I've got the tickets for the 19th of Jan. You do remember promising to take them, don't you?
What other promise might I have made after the fifth glass of the Erskine Brown Saint-Emilion?
I'd love to be one of the party. And will old Claude be buying us dinner afterwards?
I really don't think you should go around calling people old, Rumpole.
Phillida now looked miffed, and I downed the sherry before she took it into her head to deprive me of it.
Claude's got us tickets for Pavarotti, L'Elysée d'Amore. You might buy the children a burger after the show. Oh, and it's not far from us on the tube to bring them home. It really was sweet of you to invite them.
At which she smiled at me and refilled my glass in a way which made it clear she was not prepared to hear further argument. It all turned out better than I could have hoped. Tristan and Isolde, unlike their Wagnerian namesakes, were cheerful, reasonably polite, and only seemed anxious to disassociate themselves as far as possible from the old fart who was escorting them.
Uncle Horace?
At every available opportunity, they would touch me for cash and then scamper off to buy ice cream, chocolates, sandwiches, and Sprite. At last, they were settled in the stalls, snacking contentedly as the story of Aladdin and his wonderful lamp unfolded before our eyes.
New lamps for old! A new lamps for old!
Hello, children! Isn't it a beautiful day? Oh, by the way, have you seen an old lamp cell around here? Where is he?
New lamps for old!
Oh, there you are, lamp seller. Look, I brought this old lamp we had in our kitchen at home.
Ooh, what a beauty!
Yes, and it's all mine.
Aladdin was a personable young woman named in the programme as Millicent Greenway, who trained at RADA and played the popular barmaid in Liverpool Street, a long-running television series set in the railway station of that name. She had an upturned nose, coppery hair, memorable thighs, and a voice that could have been used to control crowds or low-flying aircraft.
Bye-bye, boys and girls! See you later! Be good!
Uncle Abenaza was also played by a star of television, famed for his role as caring social worker in the series Counseling. Regrettably, Wishy and Washy sang Delilah to the accompaniment of electric guitars. But Widow Twankey, acted by a certain Jim Diamond, was all a dame should be.
Aladdin!
A nimble little cockney fitted up with a sizable false bosom, thick makeup, a flaming red wig, sweeping eyelashes and scarlet lips, never have I heard the immortal line, "Where's that naughty boy Aladdin got to?" better deliver.
Gracious me.
Oh. Now, where's that naughty boy Aladdin got to?
Out in the street.
Huh? Oh, out in the street, is he? Hmm. He ought to be helping me with the laundry. Only help that boy ever gives me is to open the washing machine door. Oh. Oh, what on earth's this? Is this next door's bra or a couple of pudding basins? And this? A mountain climber's rope or Anne Widdicombe's G-string? Oh, dear. Mrs. Gormley's white knickers. Make a nice tent, they would. Or she could run them up a flagpole as a sign of surrender.
She was stuffing absurd laundry into a vast washing-up machine, firing off the old jokes as though no one had ever heard them before.
My husband, Mr. Twankey, wasn't much help either. He's long gone, of course. Oh, my husband. He could bring happiness and laughter into our house simply by not coming home. The next door, Mrs. Gormley. Bit of a nosy parker, Mrs. Gormley. She said to me, "Quite honestly, isn't your husband a bit of a pain in the neck?" "Quite honestly, Mrs. Gormley," I told her, "I've got a lower opinion of him than that." Aladdin! Aladdin! Oh, where's that naughty boy got to? Men. You know, they can get a man on the moon, can't they? Well, I don't know why they can't put them all up there. I'll tell you something. I will tell you something. I hate housework. I hate it. You make the beds, do the dishes, and 6 months later, you've got to do them all over again. Oh, it's getting dark. Where's my old lamp?
Aladdin's got it.
Oh, where is that naughty boy then?
Hello, boys and girls. Oh, what ugly audience. Get out of it.
Uncle Ebenezer, you found my naughty boy.
He was doing some sort of trade with a lamp seller.
Trade? What sort of trade?
I know you'll be pleased, Mother. I swapped our nasty old lamp for a beautiful new one.
That thing? You traded in our lovely old lamp for that thing? Anyway, it's all dusty.
I thought you'd be so pleased. Aren't you going to let me kiss you, Mother?
Certainly not. Get away from me. Keep your kisses to yourself. I never know where they've been.
Not a very affectionate mother, this widow, thank you.
She's not, is she, Uncle Horace?
You do love me, don't you, Mother?
Oh, dear.
Oh, yes. You make me want to jump for joy.
Off a cliff.
Now, this lamp, my dear Twankey, might I suggest a quick rub with a duster?
Oh, get away with you. I don't do that sort of thing.
Oh, the lamp. I meant if you give the lamp a quick polish.
Oh, all right. There should be a duster down there.
Oh, yes, there it is, in the bread bin.
That's it. See what it looks like with a bit of polishing.
So she polished the lamp. And gave the twins the surprise of their young lives.
Who's he, Uncle Horace?
The slave of the lamp.
I am the slave of the lamp.
Oh, really? We weren't expecting you. I've been staying in for the plumber to come about the ball cock.
It is my pleasure and privilege. Oh, beauteous mistress of the blue horizon.
Ever so nicely spoken, isn't it?
To grant you 3 wishes.
What's he talking about?
Go on, tell him what your heart desires.
He's a genie, Mother.
Is that what he is?
Go on, have a wish.
Oh, all right, then.
No, no, not you, her.
There.
Oh, I wish. I wish.
Yes?
You wish what? Oh, Queen of the Hidden Lakes.
Oh, wish all this washing was done.
Between washing, huge knickers, mammoth bras, red and white striped vest fell from above onto the stage.
Oh, marvellous.
And then...
And your next wish, oh, most beauteous one.
Shall I?
Why not? You still have one left.
I think I'd like... a nice...
kipper for my breakfast.
Oh!
I could hardly believe it. It was a traditional pantomime in the best possible tradition. And down came the song sheet, and now the words were... just the same. Well, perhaps the song had been dug out by some enthusiast from a pile of old pantomime numbers, gathering dust in a theatrical attic. Perhaps it had never died, but merely gone underground, like a revolutionary ditty to be sung in private by superannuated dames or elderly principal boys. And now it emerged in its full glory.
You keep your salmon and lobster too, feed your mackerel to seals at the zoo. For breakfast and dinner I've only one wish, the glorious sight of my favourite fish. Whoa! Since I was a nipper, I've always loved a kipper.
What's a kipper, Uncle Horace?
A gorgeous thing, smoked herring full of bone. Butter it well and have it for breakfast.
Dad has muesli for breakfast. Mama's hot water and lemon.
Now they're going to ask us to sing.
Let's hear it from all those up on the shelves.
Since I was a snipper,
not us. You wait, our turn will come.
And so has my loving wife.
Gone very quiet up there, hasn't it?
Yeah, oh dear. Let's try the lot in the bargain basement.
Let's hope they've got a bit more snap in their celery. Come on then. All of you down below.
Since I was a nipper, I've always loved a kipper, and so has my loving wife.
Come on, kids, sing up.
If you know a girl just zipper, a nice and fresh and kipper, and she'll be yours for life.
It was, in fact, and in fairness, all a traditional pantomime should be. And yet I had a vague feeling that something was wrong. An element was missing. But as the cast came down a white staircase in glittering costumes to enthusiastic applause, it seemed the sort of pantomime I'd grown up with, and which Tristan and Isolde should be content to inherit. After so much excitement, I felt in need of a stiff brandy and soda. But the eatery the children had selected for their evening entertainment had apparently gone teetotal, and alcohol was not on the menu.
Uncle Horace? Oh, thank you ever so much, Uncle Horace.
Oh, my pleasure, my pleasure. Look, I'm just popping out back in a tick.
Once they were confronted by their mammoth burgers and fries, I made my excuses, said I'd be back in a moment, and slipped into the nearby pub, which was, I noticed, opposite the stage door of the Empire. As the life-giving draught was being poured, I found myself standing next to Washy and Uncle Abenaza, now out of costume, who were discussing Jim the Dame.
Jim's a bit unfriendly tonight. Locks himself in his dressing room before the show and won't come in here for a drink afterwards. I reckon he's upset about something.
Can't be a star billing. He's way up there with Millicent from Liverpool Street. Maybe he's had a bust-up with Molly.
Unlikely. Jim and Molly never had a cross word. Of course, there are things she doesn't know
about. Could I have a reefer, please? Alcohol level sunk to a dangerous level.
You mean she may have found out that Jim's been polishing Aladdin's wonderful lamp?
No, I don't reckon she knows that. If she did, we'd have heard about it.
Yeah, I suppose so. Oh, Jim was in great form tonight, though, wasn't he?
He was never better. There was one funny thing, though.
Oh, yeah?
You know those artificial knockers Jim wears? Strapped on polystyrene, hard as bloody iron. Bruises me when I dance with him.
Not much fun, then, dancing with Jim.
Well, not usually. But tonight, it was all quite soft.
Got a new costume, had he?
Oh.
Yeah, perhaps he borrowed them from a blow-up doll.
They were both laughing as I gulped my brandy and legged it back to the hamburgers. In the dark passage outside the stage door, I saw a small, nimble figure in hurried retreat. Jim Diamond, I thought, who for some reason hadn't wanted to join the boys at the bar. After I had restored the children to the Erskine Browns' au pair, I sat in the tube on my way back to Gloucester Road and read the programme. Jim Diamond, it seemed, had started his life in industry before taking up show business. He had a busy career in clubs and turned down appearances on television.
I only enjoy live shows, Jim says. I want to have the audience where I can see him. His photograph, without the exaggerated female makeup, showed a pale, thin-nosed, disagreeable little man, with a lip curled either in scorn or triumph. Stripped of his makeup, there was something about this comic's unsmiling face which brought back memories of another meeting in totally different circumstances. It was the second time within a few weeks that I had found an old familiar face cast in a new and unexpected part. The idea, the memory I couldn't quite grasp, preyed on my mind until I was tucked up in bed. Hilda was already asleep. Her latest historical romance had dropped from her weary fingers. She had turned her back on me, and I saw the face in the programme again quite clearly, but in a different setting. Not Diamond, not Sparker, but Sparks Man. A logical progression.
Got it.
Is that you, Rumpel?
I don't know who else it could possibly be. You know the extraordinary thing about that pantomime?
Oh, tell me tomorrow.
The Widow Twankey was played by Jim Sparksman, a one-time safe-breaker who took to acting in one of Her Majesty's prisons.
Typical of you, Rumpel. You can't even go to the pantomime without meeting some criminal or other. Good night.
Good night. What a thing. Oh, since I was a nipper, I've always loved a kipper, and so has my love.
No singing, Rumpel.
Yes, dear.
Dennis, are you talking about Dennis, Mr. Rumpel? The boy couldn't have done it, Mr. Rumpel.
Well, do you really think so, Fred?
Not a complicated bloody great job to that extent. His only way of getting at a safe was to dig it out of the wall and remove it bodily. He done that in a Barkingside boutique job. And what was inside it hardly covered the cost of the petrol.
I was back at work. The days of kipper songs and magic lamps, of genies and church spires had passed. I was in my room in Chambers in discussion with one of my most regular customers, a member of the family of South London villains known as the Timpsons, who confined themselves to ordinary, decent crime, such as middle-of-the-road shoplifting, and disapproved as strongly as anyone of drug dealing, incest, and the carrying of shooters.
My young nephew Dennis, quite honestly, Mr. Rumpel, he's never going to be Brain of Britain. He could never have done that Croydon Savings Bank job. That called for special skills, Mr. Rumpel. And quite honestly, again, there's no one in our family today that could reach them dizzy heights.
Really? The speaker was Fred Timpson, clear-headed and sensible. And now, after the retirement of his elder brother to a small but comfortable villa on the sunnier side of Mabea, head of the family.
So far as your nephew is concerned, Fred, there is the evidence of young Charlie Malloy.
Oh, Peanuts Malloy? Well, we've heard from him before, haven't we, Mr. Rumpel?
Indeed we had. He had figured in a number of Timpson cases, and we knew absolutely nothing to his credit.
Peanuts indeed. He says he was one of the lookout men. He also says that your Dennis was in charge.
Oh, yeah, in charge. Our Dennis couldn't be in charge of a group of girl guides playing hopscotch. He's barely in charge of himself, Mr. Rumpel.
Yeah, I think you're right there. Yeah. Well, he goes on to say that Dennis disconnected the burglar alarm, burnt his way into the safe, and got his hands on 50,000 in cash.
Oh, dirty little grass, that Peanuts.
Undoubtedly, but that's what he says.
And does he go on to say that our Dennis jumped over a 20-foot wall, walked on his hands down Croydon High Street, and took off in a hot air balloon?
No, Fred, he doesn't say that.
Oh, Peanuts, he's a Malloy, Mr. Rumpel. And do you know what? The Timpsons and the Malloys is chalk and cheese.
That's very true.
It was worse than that. The Clan Malloy, who had no inhibitions about dealing in hallucinatory substances or going to work tooled up with flick knives and shooters, waged a perpetual turf war against Fred's family. If Peanuts felt like grassing, his victim would surely be a Timpson.
I'm going to see your young Dennis in Brixton. We'll find out what he says.
Oh, good luck, sir. I'm afraid you won't find that he's got a lot to offer, not by way of conversation.
We'll do our best.
And you can't believe what he says, not even if he tells you he done it.
To give myself a breather from the Timpson case, I went and stood outside my chambers in Equity Court, wearing my hat to protect the thinning top of my head from the drizzle, and thinking, as my old darling Wordsworth would say, of old, unhappy, far-off things and crimes so long ago. Around me in the doorways, under the arches or leaning against a sheltered wall, were many poor souls like me, driven out of doors. Most of them were girls. Short-skirted, high-heeled, with cigarettes dangling from their lips, they would seem to any passerby to be ladies of the night. And the same casual observer might have been forgiven for supposing that the Outer Temple, home of the legal profession, had become a red-light district in the manner of downtown Amsterdam. The casual observer would have been wrong. Neither they nor I were out of doors to offer sexual services. We were temporary exiles from chambers which had become smoke-free zones. Claude Erskine Brown blamed my cheroots for the fact that his aunt had been flooded out by a climate change in Surrey. In vain I argued for the democratic right of minorities. The smoking ban was introduced by a tyrannical majority, so I had to bask in the warmth of a small cigar as the rain settled in the brim of my hat. "Just try and remember," Claude had exhorted me. "Smoke causes global warming even out of doors. Didn't you see the pictures of Godalming in full flood?" I replied that I didn't go about searching for pictures of Godalming. "My aunt," and here Claude's voice rose to the doom-laden level of a newsreader announcing the end of the world, "had to be taken shopping in a collapsible canoe." O tempora, O mores. My faithful solicitor, Mr. Bonnie Bernard, and I made a courtesy call on young Dennis Timpson in the Brixton Prison interview room. We did our best to make him feel at home.
So, how are you feeling, Dennis?
I'm all right.
Care for a cigarette, Dennis?
I'm all right.
You must be worried about these serious charges.
I'm all right.
Fred's nephew was a puzzled 23-year-old with a shaven head, a right earring, and a poor attempt at a moustache. He sat staring out of the window at the yard with its sunken flowerbeds and screws parading with their dogs. Only one thing stirred him into some sort of eloquence.
Your Uncle Fred says you couldn't have done anything nearly as big and complicated as the Croydon job.
Who does he think he is? Uncle Fred Bloody Timpson. Hardly a cray, is he? Hardly a great train robber. What's he got on his bloody record, eh? Nicking a van load of frozen pizzas. That's about the most Uncle Fred Timpson's got to boast about. Calls himself head of the family. Everybody's wrinkly old grandpa. How does that old fart know what I'm capable of? I'll tell you to your face, Mr. Rumpo. I'm capable of a lot.
What are you trying to tell us, Dennis?
My instructing solicitor, Mr. Bernard, asked the relevant question.
Are you trying to tell us you blew the safe in the Croydon savings bank?
No, I'm not telling you that, one way or the other.
What are you telling us, then?
I'm telling you that I've got the capacity. That's what I'm telling you. Just how many safes has Uncle Fred blown in his entire existence?
Dennis was apparently incapable of answering a simple question. He'd have made a perfect politician.
Well, we're going now, Dennis. You'd better make up your mind whether you did it or not.
Out of the shades of the prison house, Bonnie Bernard took a gloomy view of the situation.
Hopeless. We've got ourselves a client who wants to boast about a crime he didn't do. Or did he?
My mind was on another aspect of the case.
The 19th of January.
Yeah, that was the date of the Croydon Savings Bank job.
Yeah, it also happens to be the night I saw Aladdin at the Tufnell Park Empire.
What on earth's that got to do with it?
I don't know. It might just be worth our while to find out.
Dennis Timpson's case was to come up for committal at the magistrate's court before Skimpy Simpson, whose lack of success at the bar had driven him to a job as a stipendiary beak. His nickname had been earned by the fact that he had never, within living memory, been known to lash out on a round of drinks in Pomeroy's wine bar. In the usual course of events, there's no future in fighting proceedings, which are only there to commit the customer to trial. I had resolved to attend, however, to pour a little well-deserved contempt on the evidence of Peanuts Malloy. There was also the possibility that Bernard might provide me with a valuable witness. But the situation was by no means clear when I rose to cross-examine the officer in charge of the case.
Detective Inspector Grimble. Would you agree that whoever blew the safe in the Croydon Savings Bank did an extraordinarily skillful job?
Mr. Lumpo, are we meant to congratulate your client on his professional skills?
Exactly the opposite, sir.
I decided to ignore Skimpy and concentrate on a friendly chat with Detective Inspector Grimble, a large, comfortable gingerhead officer. We had lived together over many years with the Clan Timpson and their misdoings.
You'd agree, then, these thieves were well informed. They knew there would be a week's money in the safe.
They knew that, yes.
And was there a complex burglar alarm system that couldn't be put out of action simply by cutting the wires?
Cutting the wires would have set it off.
Ah, so putting the burglar alarm out of action would have required special skills.
It would have done.
Putting it out of action also stopped a clock in the office, so we know that occurred at 8:45.
We know that, yes.
And at 9:20, young Malloy was caught as he fell running to a getaway car.
That is so.
So this heavy safe was burnt open in little over half an hour.
I fail to see the relevance of that, Mr. Rumpo.
Skimpy was getting restless.
Don't worry, sir. I'm sure the officer does. that shows a very high degree of technical skill, doesn't it, Detective Inspector?
Oh, well, yes, of course, I'd agree with that.
Exercised by a highly experienced Peterman.
Who is this Mr. Peterman? We haven't heard of him before.
I marveled at the ignorance of the basic facts of life displayed by the magistrate.
A man expert at blowing safes, sir. Known to the trade as a Peterman.
Yes, of course.
We're agreed, Inspector, that this was a highly expert piece of work.
It must have been done by someone who knew his job pretty well, yes.
Dennis Timpson's record shows convictions for shoplifting, bag snatching, and stealing a radio from an unlocked car. In all of these simple enterprises, he managed to get caught.
Your client's criminal record. You're allowing that to go into evidence, are you, Mr. Rumpo?
Certainly, sir, because there's absolutely no indication that he was capable of blowing a safe in record time or silencing a complicated burglar alarm. Am I right, Detective Inspector?
You are, Mr. Rumpo. There's nothing to show anything like that in his record.
Would you agree, then, that in the profession of thieving, young Dennis Timpson is an incompetent amateur?
Well, hang on a minute. What's he calling me? Incompetent amateur? What's that mean? Dickhead? I've got to sit here listening to me being called a dickhead? Mr. Lumpole, cannot you control your client?
It's very difficult, sir. Might I step into the dock and give him legal advice?
It might be as well.
The legal advice I gave Dennis Timpson came in a whisper, which apparently echoed round the court.
Shut up, you little twerp, or I'll go home and leave you to it. Understand?
Oh, don't do that.
The consultation over, I continued my agreeable dialogue with Detective Inspector Grimble.
Is it a fact that the number of expert petermen is strictly limited?
I believe that is so.
And they are, by and large, known to the police?
We have our sources of information, yes.
Mr. Rumpel, where is all this leading?
Back a good many years, sir, to the Home Sweet Home Building Society job at Cosh Shorten, when Jim Sparksman blew a safe so quietly that even the dog slept through it.
You were on that case, weren't you, Mr. Rumpo? Sparksman got 5 years.
Not one of your great successes. Perhaps you wasted the court's time with unnecessary questions. Have you anything else to ask this officer?
One thing. Inspector, doesn't this crime bear all the hallmarks of an expert safe blower? Like, for instance, Jim Sparksman, now known as Jim Diamond, who now has a new career on the stage.
I must admit, Mr. Rumpole, my thoughts did turn in that direction.
That's very helpful. So have you checked Jim Diamond's movements on the evening of the 19th of January? Where was he at 8 o'clock?
If you really want to know, Mr. Rumpole.
I certainly do.
He was performing in the Christmas pantomime Aladdin at the Tufnell Park Empire. I'm afraid he has a cast-iron alibi.
So, that's that, Mr. Rumpole. Now, could we get on with dealing with the facts of this case?
No, we couldn't. And that was because, as I looked desperately round the court, I saw no sign of my faithful solicitor, Bonnie Bernard, nor of the witness he had promised to deliver to me.
Mr. Rumpole, no doubt you will reserve your evidence until the trial at the Old Bailey.
No, sir, I have a witness to call before you.
Oh, very well. Call your witness.
If only I could. It was 3:30, and the clerk of the court had told me Skimpy had to leave at 4 to catch his usual train home to Haywards Heath. So I claimed the right to make an opening speech for the defence, something unknown in a magistrate's court.
Sitting as a magistrate, you, sir, are not a rubber stamp. You are not a mere pillar box, put here to send cases onto the Central Criminal Court. You can. It's your duty to consider the prosecution on its merits. And should you decide it has no merits whatever, throw it out.
I wittered on about safe-breaking in general and the use of blowtorches. I touched on the great institution of savings banks. I discussed the geography of Croydon. I praised the honesty and acumen of Detective Inspector Grimble and touched on the history of committal proceedings. I was about to be driven back on the weather when Skimpy looked wearily at the clock and stopped me with a high, pitched bark.
Have your witness here first thing tomorrow, Rumpole, or I come to an immediate decision.
So Skimpy head off to Victoria Station. And in the morning...
Silence in court.
I called Mrs. Diamond.
I swear by Almighty God that the evidence I shall give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Are you Molly Diamond?
I am.
Are you married to Jim Diamond, as he is now known?
I am. You can call it a marriage.
When you married him, wasn't he Jim Sparksman?
That was his proper name.
And under that name, did he serve a long term of imprisonment?
Yeah. I stood by him during all that time.
And what was he in prison for?
Blowing the safe on the Home Sweet Home Building Society in Carl Shulton.
Was blowing safes his trade or profession when you first met him?
That was what he did most of, yes.
Mrs. Diamond smiled, I thought, with a certain modest pride. But Skimpy didn't seem entirely happy with the evidence I was calling.
Mr. Rumpole, we're investigating your client's involvement in a raid on a savings bank in Croydon. What on earth has this man Diamond, or Sparksman, or what it is called, got to do with this case, I wonder?
I looked round the court and saw Detective Inspector Grimble murmuring to the solicitor from the Crown Prosecution Service. I had warned Grimble that my witness might solve the savings bank mystery, and I expected him to help me to drag the truth out, like a bad tooth, from the jaws of the impatient Skimpy.
You say you wonder, sir. Mm. Then wander on till truth makes all things plain. All will be revealed.
Mr. Kemp, don't you object to this evidence?
Skimpy sought help from the prosecutor, a young man who'd listened to Grimble's advice.
No, sir. The prosecution has no objection.
Oh, very well, Mr. Von Pearl, but keep it short.
Coming to the evening of the 19th of January, was your husband playing Widow Twankey in the pantomime?
Not that night, no.
Goodness. At the Tufnell Park Empire, I was in the audience.
Mr. Rumpole, stop giving evidence.
Then let me suggest that someone was playing Widow Twankey on the night of the Croydon Savings Bank raid.
That was me.
Goodness me.
But perhaps you could tell us how that came about.
I'd done bits and pieces. Variety shows, summer season, stuff like that, before I met Jim. While he was away, of course, I did a bit more of it, just to keep things going. Well, I took an interest in his work, too. I watched rehearsals. I knew Twankey backwards.
Mr. Kemp, are you still not objecting?
No, sir.
You were saying, Mrs. Diamond, before we were interrupted.
So when Jim asked me to stand in for him...
What did you do?
Well, I did what he wanted.
I was looking at the woman in the witness box, quiet, nervous, overawed by the proceedings. And suddenly I saw her again. Her lips scarlet, her face caked with makeup, crowned with a tousled red wig, as she dashed on with her arms full of washing and yelled at the children.
Aladdin!
Where's that naughty boy got to?
And then the glorious vision faded, and we were back in the South London Magistrates' Court.
Did he tell you why he wanted you to play Twankey?
He said, like, it was a deadly secret. But he had to do a job he didn't want anyone to know about. It was something he had to do round Croydon way.
You were to give him an alibi?
Well, that's what I thought it was. I thought I loved him then. Not now. Not now I don't. That little tart, that Millicent... She can no more play Aladdin than I could play football for England. He only moved in with her. That's all he did. Moved into a stinking little tart's flat in Wimbledon Common, if you can believe it. Well, that did it. That put the old tin lid on it. I'm not helping him after that. He's yours now. You can do what you like with him.
It was the voice, strident, outrageous, ultimately alarming, of the widow Twankey. And as it died away... The young man from the Crown Prosecution Service got rather shakily, I thought, to his feet.
Might this case be adjourned, sir, so that we can make further inquiries?
Detective Inspector Grimble arrested Jim Sparksman, also known as Diamond, for the Croydon job, and the case against Dennis Timpson was dropped. Deeply preoccupied by the fresh challenge of a new case, my breakfast next morning was rudely interrupted by she who must be obeyed. I heard a heavy sigh on the other side of the toast and marmalade. Hilda's face was a study of sadness and regret as she looked down at the letter in her hand.
I can't possibly go. It would be too embarrassing.
You can't go where, Hilda?
The old St. Elfrieda's dinner.
But you always go.
Not now.
It was a reunion Hilda never missed. A party at which her innumerable old school friends relived their gym-slip years, and which I welcomed as an opportunity for a quietly convivial evening in Pomeroy's wine bar with Bonnie Bernard.
Look at this.
She handed me the embossed invitation, as though it were the announcement of a death.
The president of the OEs this year is Lady Shiplake, Chrissy Snelling as was. It's so not fair. She never came to OE reunions. But now she's married this Labour lord, they've made her president. Neither Dodo McIntosh nor I will be able to go now.
Why ever not?
There was a long and solemn pause, and then Hilda uttered a word which I didn't know existed in her vocabulary.
Guilt.
You mean this Chrissy has a criminal record?
No, we do. Dodo and I.
Hilda! The breath had been knocked out of me. You're confessing to something.
Dodo and I did it together.
You were fellow conspirators? In what crime?
We called her Smelling, of course. Here comes Chrissy Smelling. And we held our noses. Oh, we told her there was a rule that everyone had to run round the hockey field 3 times before breakfast. And Chrissy did it. Oh, we sent her fake Valentine cards, making dates with non-existent chaps from the boys' school. Oh, we pinched her knicker linings and punctured her hot water bottle.
Oh, disgusting.
Then halfway through one term, a car with a chauffeur came and took Chrissy away. It was all our fault, Rumpole.
Any other offences to be taken into consideration? I hope I looked suitably shocked.
I can't think of any more at the moment.
It's a formidable charge sheet.
I know. And now Dodo and I simply couldn't face her again. Neither of us could.
That's exactly why you got to go.
For once in my married life, I was occupying the moral high ground, where the air was fresh and exciting.
Oh, Rumpole!
Could it be that she who must be obeyed was capable of a cry for help?
Don't make me.
Could I make her? Could I turn Judge Bullingham into a soft-hearted, do-gooding member of the Howard League for Penal Reform? Of course I couldn't. All the same, I meant to put up a fight for my evening with Bonnie Bernard in Pomeroy's.
I just think...
And here I gave Hilda the Rumpo look of gentle but serious concern.
That you have the honour of St. Elfrida's to consider.
Dodo and I have always been intensely loyal to the old school.
Always in the past, perhaps, but not now. Or is it part of the St. Elfrida's tradition to run away from your responsibilities?
What do you want me to do, Rumpole?
Ah, another record broken. Such a question had never been asked before in the long, windy history of our married life.
Face up to it, Hilda. Confess everything and throw yourself at the mercy of the court. I am convinced...
And now Rumpole was at his most judicial.
...that you and Dodo McIntosh will feel the better, the purer for it.
For a long moment, the fate of my evening at Pomeroy's hung in the balance. Then she said...
I'll ring Dodo and ask her what she thinks.
You won't. You'll tell her what you think. I said, but not out loud. By now, I was satisfied that ringing Dodo would end in agreement that they should face the music. And so, a week or two later, Bonnie Bernard and I were able to enjoy an evening unfettered by domestic commitments in Pomeroy's wine bar. Over our second bottle of Chateau Thames Embankment, we discussed the recent Timpson case, and my solicitor was able to tell me exactly how he'd managed to trace Molly to her brother's house in Birmingham. She'd fled there when Jim Diamond, the notorious Peterman, had finally left her.
She couldn't wait to tell me her story. That poor bloody Jim. Mm. She hated him. But there's something I don't understand, Rumpole.
What's that?
Well, what put you onto her?
Well, it was the strange failure of Jim to join the other actors for a drink after the show and what I heard in the pub. They said Jim had been polishing Aladdin's wonderful lamp.
was that all?
And Abenazer said he felt an unexpected softness. When he danced with Widow Twankey. But even before that, while I was watching the pantomime, I knew that something was wrong. Bonnie, it has taken some time for me to realize what I actually witnessed that night at the Tufnell Park Empire.
Oh, and what was that, Rumpole?
It was nothing less than an outrage to a great British tradition. Widow Twankey, being played by a woman.
Dear, dear.
Yes. I arose next morning, I confess, a little tardily, to be greeted by a cooked breakfast and the surprisingly cheerful countenance of she who must be obeyed. I ventured a question.
Oh, by the way, how was the old girl's reunion?
It went extremely well. In fact, it was a whole lot of fun. Dodo and I enjoyed it hugely.
I try to imagine what sort of fun the old St. Elfrida's girls got up to. Failed and said,
"But I thought you were dreading it."
Oh, we were.
How was Chrissy, what's her name?
You mean Chrissy Snelling? Lady Shipling, now. Oh, she was in the chair.
And cut you two dead, did she?
Not at all. She was enormously pleased to see us. She kept saying what an entertaining pair we were at school. She said we were a laugh a minute.
She said that?
I tried to picture she who must be obeyed and her friend Dodo McIntosh as two capering schoolgirls, constantly telling jokes and irritating the science mistress, but failed again.
But you said that she left because of you and Dodo.
Oh, she explained that. It was nothing to do with us.
It wasn't?
No. Chris's father.
Snelling.
Oh, yes, anyway. He was high up in the Foreign Office, and he got posted to Washington. So they decided to send her to school over there. It was quite a sudden decision.
And no one told you that?
No one.
So you felt guilty all these years?
Up till last night, yes. As I said to Dodo, it's quite a weight off my mind.
It must be.
Then I rose from the table and began to stuff my papers into my battered briefcase. I placed my pen in my top pocket and submerged my dirty plate and cutlery in the washing-up bowl, in accordance with the law formulated by she who must be obeyed.
Rumpole?
The voice of authority was particularly sharp that morning.
Have you the remotest idea what you have just done?
No remote idea, Hilda. I have prepared for work. I am going out into the harsh, unsympathetic world of a crown court for the sole purpose of keeping this leaky old mansion flat afloat and well stocked with fairy liquid and such like luxuries.
Is this the way you usually prepare for work?
Yes, by consuming a light-cooked breakfast and doing a bit of last-minute housework. How else?
And I suppose you intend to appear in court with the butter knife sticking out of your top pocket, having thrown your fountain pen into the sink.
Oh, good God.
A glance at my top pocket told me that she who must be obeyed, forever eagle-eyed, had sized up the situation pretty accurately.
A moment of confusion, I agree. My mind was on more serious matters. The absolution of my dear wife's guilt.
Time passed. Spring came to the Temple Gardens. The crocuses were out. They were fresh, green leaves and white blossom. When one morning Hilda opened a letter from Norfolk, she read it out to me.
The repointing's going well on the spire, and we hope to have it finished by Easter. And I have to tell you, Hilda, the oil-fired heating has changed our lives. Eric says it's like living in the tropics. Cooking supper last night, I had to peel off my Shetland woolly and my hand-knitted alpaca cardigan. Oh, dear Poppy.
She who must be obeyed put down the letter from her old school friend, Poppy Longstaff.
Noblesse oblige.
What was that, Hilda?
I could tell at once that Donald Compton was a true gentleman, the sort that does good by stealth. Of course, poor old Eric thought he'd never get the tower mended, but I somehow felt that Donald wouldn't fail him. It was noblesse.
Perhaps it was, but in this case the noblesse was Horace Rumpole's.
Rumpole? What on earth do you mean? You hardly paid to have the church spire repointed, did you?
In one sense, yes.
I can't believe that. After all the years it took you to have the bathroom decorated, what on earth do you mean about your noblesse?
Oh, it'd take too long to explain. But that which I am, I am. We are not now that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven. That which we are, we are. One equal temper of heroic hearts, made weak by time and fate, but strong in will, to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield.
and not to yield? I'm not quite sure about that.
Easter came, the work on the spire was successfully completed, and I was walking back to chambers after a gruelling day down the bailey when I saw, wafting through the temple cloisters, the unlikely apparition of the Reverend Eric Longstaff. He chirruped a greeting.
My dear Rumpo, terribly good to see you. Do you know, I'm so profoundly grateful that I decided to invite you down to the rectory last Christmas.
You decided?
Of course I did.
I thought your wife Poppy extended the invitation to she who must be obeyed.
Ah, dear Hilda, yes, but I thought of the idea. It was the result of a good deal of hard knee work and guidance from above. I knew you were the right man for the job.
What job?
The Compton job.
What was this? The rector was speaking like an old con. The Compton job?
What can you mean?
I just mean that I knew you defended Donald Compton in his previous existence.
How on earth did you know that?
Eric drew himself up to his full willowy height and spoke proudly.
I'm not a prison visitor for nothing. So I thought you were just the chap to put the fear of God into him. You were the very person to put the squeeze on the Lord of the Manor.
Words were beginning to fail me.
Put the squeeze on him?
That was the idea. It came to me as a result of hard, hard knee work.
So you brought us down to that freezing rectory just so I could blackmail the local benefactor.
Didn't it turn out well?
May the Lord forgive you.
He is very forgiving.
I spoke to the man of God severely.
Well, the next time the church can do its blackmailing for itself.
It was then that the rector smiled at me in a lofty manner.
Oh, we're quite used to that. Particularly around Christmas.
In Rumpole and the Old Familiar Faces, Rumpole was played by Desmond Barrett. Hilda, she who must be obeyed, Joanna David. The Reverend Eric Longstaff, Oliver Ford Davis, and Donald Compton, Tim McInerney. Fred Timpson was played by Nigel Anthony. Phyllida Erskine Brown, Patience Tomlinson. Judge Bullingham, Philip Voss, Skimpy Simpson, Joanne Meredith, and Bonnie Bernard, Bruce Alexander. Detective Inspector Grimble was played by John Hartley. Aladdin, Rebecca Lacey, Dennis Timpson, Tom George, Widow Twankey, Tilly Vosborough, Tristan Lewis Rees, and Isolde, Lauren Bird. The pantomime music was written and played by Neil Brown. Rumpole and the Old Familiar Faces was written by John Mortimer, directed by Marilyn Imrie, and is a Catherine Bailey production for BBC Radio 4.